Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200. Big win for the White Sox today. And a nice night. Some creepy weather out west. We'll pay attention to that. Jen DeSalvo's got that for you tonight. Pete Zimmerman's here as well. We'll get to the show. We got an amazing show lined up tonight. Loosely based on the theme 1989. No, not the Taylor Swift album. The year, 30 years ago. Some amazing stories that impacted our city and our world, especially when it comes to arts and culture and sports. For example, Tracy Edwards will be in studio. She was a skipper of the Maiden, a boat that sailed around the world in 1989. She led the first ever all-female crew in the Whitbread Round the World Yacht Race. It's a great new documentary coming out about the race and that historic moment. She'll be in studio in our 8 o'clock hour. What about music? 1989 was just before the alt-rock takeover, featuring bands like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and the Smashing Pumpkins. But quietly, indie rock legend Superchunk started their career in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. They continue to not only be one of the most prolific indie rock bands of all time, but Mac and Laura founded Merge Records, which reps so many influential bands, bands like Dinosaur Jr., Bob Mould, later Arcade Fire. We'll talk with them coming up a little bit later in the show. Also tonight, we focus in on some of the big art stories from 30 years ago, including a fire in River North. The now glitzy Chicago neighborhood was home to the contemporary arts community, but a huge fire in 1989 changed all of that and led way for a different kind of change, for better or worse. We'll talk about that story and also celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Neo-Futurists, Chicago's longest-running late-night theater company that helped give voice to so many great artists, plus a home to so many young audience members. Those conversations coming up. And it's not just a nostalgic trip tonight. We can get loose with this theme. Chicago hip-hop artist and poet Mikel DeVille has new music out. He's playing the Logan Square Art Festival this weekend. He performs live in our performance studio. Oh, yeah, and you guessed it. He was born in 1989. All that, plus your memories of that fine year. 312-981-7200. You can text and call. It's extension 720. But first, you know, When you start working on a project like this, any project like this, you start to see it in everything you do, right? I feel like that's been this week for me with this show. We decided to do 1989, and then at almost every turn, a new story or a piece of history or a fun factoid would pop up. So that got us thinking, what was so special about that year? It turns out plenty. If you truly want to understand why Chicago is Chicago, look no further than 1989. Our news, our issues, our sports, our celebrity, our arts and culture, heck, even our weather. I spent the last couple days looking into the big stories of that year, and I was surprised at how many big moments shaped our identity for years to come. Just to start at the top, Chicago elected a new mayor in 1989. After the death of Harold Washington in 1987, Eugene Sawyer held the position until there was a special election in 1989. The former state's attorney and son of the former mayor, Richard M. Daley, he won big. And eventually stayed in power longer than his father did. He left office in 2011. That all started in 1989. Or how about crime news? Read the story in the LA Times about two Chicago black teenagers who were exonerated for murder after it became clear that their confessions were coerced by the Chicago police and a commander named John Burge. This led the paper and others around the country to coin Chicago the false confession capital of the world. And it also was the moment where Chicagoans started to realize that maybe something was amiss. According to the Trib in 2018, John Burge and police torture ended up costing taxpayers $132 million in settlements. Construction to widen the Dan Ryan Expressway ended in 1989. It was heralded as the future of expressways and would ultimately end congestion coming into and out of the city. All of our problems were solved, right? Right. It was the first year of the NBC Tower around Columbus. There's a great video online that shows the original 10 p.m. broadcast from the first day they were in there, featuring anchors Carol Marine, Ron Majors, Sports with Mark Giangreco. And the video was complete with the commercials that aired at this time, including one with this jingle.
The feeling continues when you tune your radio to WNUA.
Classic. You can't go wrong with that one. Also prominent at radio at the time, Stephen Gary, Terry Hemmert, of course, and Steve Cochran.
Smashing all the records I can get. I'll show that Steve Cochran fella from KDWB. Adios, Madonna. And put the clothes on for Pete's sake. And what's with this MC Hammer? I'll hammer you.
Actually, that was when Steve was in Minneapolis, but too good to pass up, right? It was amazing. But it wasn't just the big headlines. 1989 was the year that Ira Glass moved to Chicago. In music, the Smashing Pumpkins recorded their first track for a compilation record, Chicago Alternative Bands. On stage, the Annoyance Theater was born. In weather, it ended up snowing in May of 1989. It was the latest snowstorm on record, a record that came close to being broken in May of 2019. In sports, of course, the Cubs went to the playoffs. They lost to Will Clark and the Giants, but it was a great year for Cubby Blue, a team that was once the most successful in Cubs history until the current one that's on the field tonight. The Bulls gave up on coach Doug Collins after the 88-89 season, opting for a relatively unknown assistant coach. He used to play for the Knicks, named Phil Jackson. 1989 was also the year of the shot, and as Mark Carmen wanted me to point out, also the Game 3 winner against the Pistons. I want to leave that out. And the 1989 Bears season is remembered as the year that finally busted up the remnants of the Super Bowl team. Otis Wilson and Mike Richardson left via free agency, and Coach Dick and the Bears shocked the city by trading Jim McMahon to the Chargers during training camp. The first round pick that year, Donnell Wolford, marked the end of an era. So when you think of the complex issues, the ugly moments, the stereotypes that can haunt the city from this era, you also have to remember that there was something bubbling up underneath. There are plenty of Deep Dish and Dicka references to go around. Trust me, there are a ton of Dicka references. But at the same time, the year was one that presented a counterculture narrative, a narrative that ultimately remains as the Chicago we know and love, not the Chicago that we try to leave behind. For all the ups and downs, 1989 has had a profound impact on who we are as a city. And don't get me wrong, we like to live in the past. Hopefully, though, we're not doomed to repeat it. Stories of 1989 and more tonight on Extension 720. Stay with us. On Extension 720 tonight. We got you till 10 o'clock. Jen DeSalvo's got you in the newsroom when it comes to all of the news that's happening, including some of the debate stuff tonight, as well as some dire weather. I don't know if I'd say dire, but just some nasty weather that might be out west. So we'll pay attention to that tonight for you as well. Coming up after the 7:30 news, we're going to talk with the Chicago Gallery News to talk about the River North Fire art fire that happened in 1989 and how that shaped the neighborhood as we know it today, but also how he lost so much contemporary art in that fire. We'll talk about that coming up at 7:30. As I mentioned earlier, it's not just all a nostalgia trip. Mikel DeVille is in studio tonight, a hip-hop artist and poet. He's playing at the Logan Square Arts Festival this weekend. He's got a new album out called Maintain, which is coming out, and he's live in our studio. So let's take a listen to Mikel DeVille. Hear his song, Free Soul. Take it away.
This one's dedicated to Chicago.
West side's got the funk.
Yeah.
South side's got the funk.
Yeah.
North side's got the funk. Chi-town's got the funk. Yo. Chi-town's got some funk. Chi-town's got the funk.
Yeah. Yeah. Yo. Yo.
Episodes from my area code. We never fit the description. We breaking the mold. Ferocious soul. Chicago got explosive glow. I give a pound to my skin folk. I'm ocean. You fishbowl, swim bold. The game sold by your water sign. You drowned in the open air. Curating the timeline of dollar signs and pushing the brands all you care about. Keep your connections, fam. Forget your clubhouse clout. I do this for the conscious. Strolling with Raheem and we shouting. What about it? Through the basement. Art is the celebration. Bigging my brother up while preaching self-preservation. Can't contain the truth that's fitted between my crooked tooth. Legitimately why in the booth I'm here to save your ears from fake news. Beware of elevators plated in gold for the top and the cost your soul.
Yo, yo, west side, we gon' set this party off right. South side, we gon' set this party off right. North side, you know what it is. Let's set it off, yo,
We what the ancestors whispered about. From north to the south, we dreams from the force of their mouth. How do we walk in that potential, perforating the doubt? We make the world realize ain't no forcing us out, you dig? It's heroism or American terrorism. See through the deception, so we questing for iller rhythms. If politicking and boot licking is all you care about, keep your reflections, fam. Forget your clubhouse clout. I do this for the common sovereigns, holding down the kingdoms with their vocals. Keeping it local, no replacement. Taking our reparations, want us mentally free, but freedom is what you make of it. Deface the myth that we were never five-fifths. Embrace the fear with confidence, feeling myself like ever since. Because I know we not just pieces of a whole. Individually, we're in control. Watch us glow.
Yeah, there you go. Mikel DeVille in studio. Free Soul, the name of that track off the record Maintain, comes out just this week. Mikel DeVille is playing at the Logan Arts Arts Festival coming up this weekend, and we'll have more from the young West Side hip-hop artist and poet on the program tonight. Born in 1989. Stay with us. Music tonight, Peter Zimmerman, of course, giving you the best of 1989. A little Cure. Nice work, Pete. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. We're exploring all things 1989 and keeping you abreast of what's happening with the weather. Of course, a thunderstorm warning is in effect for Cook County and parts of DuPage County and the areas on the outskirts. So we'll definitely pay attention to that. Jen DeSalva will break in if there's anything that you need to know. 312-981-7200 is the number. Coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, the band Superchunk. Talk with them about their illustrious indie rock career. Started in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. They're celebrating their 30th anniversary and also their 25th anniversary of their seminal record, Foolish. And they put out an acoustic version of all those screamy indie rock tunes that we all fell in love with in 1994. They are an older, mellower Superchunk as they bring us acoustic jams. We'll have a conversation with them, as well as Tracy Edwards, who is her new documentary, Maiden, is all about her journey in 1989 to sail around the world as part of the Whitbread yacht race, which was, at that point, all men. There were no women allowed on these boats. And Tracy was trying to get on a boat, and she wanted to be a part of it, and no one would hire her. And she said, fine, I'll do it myself. And she led an all-female crew in 1989. And the misogyny alone in the documentary. I mean, I never knew the sailing community to be that gross, and they show up in full force in this film. But we'll talk with Tracy Edwards, who is a pioneer, and in more ways than one, coming up here in the 8 o'clock hour. Well, another story from 1989 that doesn't necessarily get talked about when it comes to Chicago history has to do with a fire. Sure, there have been bigger fires, but this one in River North not only charted a course for the contemporary art scene in town, but for a neighborhood. The River North Art Gallery fire burned for days back in April 1989, and in doing so, it destroyed galleries and collections of priceless contemporary art, and the Chicago community never fully recovered. Joining me in studio to talk about the fire is Ginny Van Ellier. She's the publisher of Chicago Gallery News, a publication that's been covering the Chicago art scene since 1983. Ginny, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you. What a story. This is a story that your article was one that I was very, very good article about this story, but this is something I don't think a lot of people paid attention to, that if it didn't necessarily affect them, about this one building that burned in 1989.
Well, if you are a part of the art world, you certainly do remember Saturday, April 15th, 1989. And full disclosure, I was not part of the art scene at that point, but my predecessor who founded Chicago Gallery News, she and her husband at the time had a gallery that was destroyed by the fire. Mm. So I have been with CGN since 2002 and heard many stories of it's a topic that comes up on a regular basis because it was so significant.
All right, take us back to 1989 River North. River North, as we know it now, is a neighborhood that houses luxury apartments and houses, and it's really sort of a glamorous, glitzy neighborhood. But back in 1989, it may have been edging that way, but it was a home for the arts community.
Well, and it sort of started basically in the first gallery that was in River North was Zola Lieberman, which had opened in 1976. And basically, a few years later, a lot of the galleries that had been along Michigan Avenue and in smaller spaces, sort of in downtown, were attracted to River North, which is a former manufacturing district, because of large former factories and mm-hmm. big industrial buildings that had huge ceilings and freight elevators and all these things that could expand the kinds of art that they were showing. So pretty quickly, a group that was called the Original 16 moved over from sort of basically where Crate and Barrel used to be, mm-hmm. Where Starbucks is going, over to Superior and Huron, and sort of that part of town.
So this is the west side of River North, where you're getting closer to the Ohio Ramp. People may know for where the Kennedy is at, and that area that you know has just exploded. I mean, to think about that area now as what it was even 20 years ago,
it's completely. It was briefly called Soho, I am told, which didn't stick, which I think is probably,
probably good.
I think somebody thought Soho, we'll do it right
there.
Yeah,
right.
But yes, it became River North, and out of that sort of dozen and a half galleries that started in the early 80s, things really exploded. And also part of that expansion was John Wilson had started the Original Art Expo at Navy Pier in 1980, which at the time was a totally novel thing to do outside of Europe.
Right.
And it put Chicago on the map. And as that grew up, a lot of galleries expanded and opened and continued to move to or open in River North.
Tell us about the building. This building was a historic building. It was an old factory of some sort.
It was designed by Louis Sullivan and Dankmar Adler.
Wow.
So it was 1881, 1901. It was sort of a collection of buildings that were the Brunswick Blake Colander plant. And it had been, I think, maybe slated for historic preservation, but not quite yet. And so it itself was huge and took up
the whole block,
and it really was sort of bounded by Huron, Sedgwick, Orleans, and Superior Street.
Mm. That's a huge amount of space. So that whole block was an old factory, and that was being used for galleries, and other people were coming in. This became a space.
There had been 22 galleries sort of in that building, and then I read that about a dozen had moved out because the building became under construction. There was a real estate development firm at the time that had owned it and decided to develop it, and it was sort of touted as like the biggest development that was going to be happening in Chicago and sort of putting River North on the map as a place to be. So there were a few galleries that were still in that building as this construction was about a year underway.
So let's take us to that day. It was April 15th, 1989. This fire, what do you know about it? How did it start and all that?
What I know is that it was early in the morning on a Saturday, which, you know, for other people, they might not be going to work, but for galleries tend to be open on Saturdays. They tend to be closed on Sundays and Mondays. So it was early in the morning, and reportedly it started in multiple places within the building. And I think it was a 6 to 7 story building. So it was, and as I said, the whole block. So it was huge. And then it quickly went to be a 5-alarm fire. And you could feel the heat, you know, blocks away. There were people who said they could see it in suburban Hillside. They could certainly see it from Lakeshore Drive. So it started and it got bad fast, partly because the building was under construction. So it was filled with piles of wood, drywall, propane. There were timber joists. Mm-hmm. It was a historic building. Like, everything about it just right. made things go fast.
In your article and the reporting on this, you know, to think about a building in today's day that smolders for weeks on end, it's not something that it can happen, but it's not something that is readily available to any of us to be like, oh, there's that building that continues to smolder. Right. This was not just about April 15th or even the subsequent days. For weeks, people were aware of a fire because it kept being on fire.
Yeah. I mean, they said at the height of the blaze, there were like 180 firefighters and 50 pieces of equipment. I mean, you know, a 5-alarm fire is calling everybody available to come and combat it. So the thing that the building smoldered for weeks, but the community did as well. And one of the dealers who was a tenant at the time had the day before gone to a Cook County judge and tried to file an injunction to stop construction because it had been underway for a year, but he and some other people in the building were afraid that there were some risky practices that were being done.
And the part of this story that continues to be a mystery is, even to this day, there isn't a cause of fire. I mean, that it was such a disaster and such a big building, it was hard to find out exactly what started the fire.
Right. As I said, people in the art community continue to talk about it. They have different, you know, experiences, different theories, different memories that come up about it. But ultimately, the fire department said that the evidence was just too badly damaged. I mean, there was nothing left to be able to rule what it was, which is just like anything else. When you can't put something to rest,
right,
it just sort of continues to be out there.
Ginny Van Elier, she's the publisher of Chicago Gallery News. We're talking about the River North Art Gallery fire that burned in 1989. And we'll take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about what was lost and, as a community tried to rebuild, what that looked like. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, celebrating 1989. Music coming in and out. Bob Mould, of course. We're right now talking about the River North Art Gallery fire that burned for days in 1989. Ginny Van Elier is here. She's the publisher of Chicago Gallery News. We're talking about this fire and catching up on the conversation. It burned for days, not unlike any of the stories about fires of this time. There are some issues. The sprinklers didn't work. The fire doors were inoperable. There were a lot of things about this fire that made it worse because of the state of the building.
Yes, definitely. And I think that, again, was going on to just sort of, for lack of a better word, fuel the theories that happened later when people were so upset, is there was such a sense of loss because everybody wants to know who to blame, and everything was sort of inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, the scene was really lively and really like the place to be. I mean, at that point in the 80s, you know, the galleries, the openings would be packed and everybody was there, and everybody was in proximity to one another. So that was another thing that made that part of River North special, is that it was not like now where things are farther afield. People were packed into buildings and all in one place, and to have a huge physical component just obliterated was traumatic in every possible way.
What was lost, material-wise? What when it was all said and done, are you losing art pieces and collections?
Yes. Obviously, the ultimate casualty was the artwork. And there were estimates that it was $50 million worth of art. Mm. There was a range of galleries and a range of artists that were in those spaces. So that was one thing. I mean, there was Chima Kobo at the time. A year's worth of work was lost from Zola Lieberman Gallery. There was an entire estate of a deceased artist at Rowe Gallery that was completely incinerated. There were dozens of artists who had work in the galleries that it was just gone. And it's different than a business that has property that can be replaced in some way. I mean, there is no way to replace it. And when you think about how the time it takes an artist to create unique work and to have it be gone, there's no turning back. So you have careers that have gaps. You have, you know, financial lifelines because people had shows coming up and they were counting on selling it. And everybody's sense at the time, you know, was sort of, my whole life is in there and it's just gone. There was also records. I mean, records of things, records. So even if an artist didn't lose artwork, maybe records about sales or provenance or anything else was irreplaceable. So at the time, right after, there were a couple of things put on by the Chicago Artist Coalition, even Leslie Hindman, to try and address some of the issues for artists at that time, like keeping your records and books off-site, getting a faster jump on being more computerized.
How do you, from your estimation and, you know, from your reporting, how did the arts community react and respond and even rebound after this fire?
Well, I think it sounds like there was just moments of, you know, people sitting on the steps and crying. I mean, Kathy Edelman, she had opened her gallery at the end of 1987 and just moved from River North to Westtown. She said at the time she saw it from Lakeshore Drive. She got there as fast as she can. She abandoned her car on Lakeshore Drive or on Chicago Avenue and got there, and everybody was just sitting and in tears. And that kind of sense lasted for a little bit, but within a week, I think the Merchandise Mart said, you can come, if you have a displaced gallery, come and be in the Mart temporarily. There was another landlord nearby who said, have space for $1 a square foot. I think there were a lot of temporary things that people tried to figure out what to do just to get people back up and running. And another reason for that was the 10th edition of Art Expo was set to happen 3 weeks later.
Wow.
Which is, like, for lack of a better word, Black Friday. I mean, it's the busiest day or time of the year for an art fair, for a gallery. So to have that happen where you're displaced, you have no records, they banded together to try and get back on their feet initially. And then after that, there was a benefit auction put on by Chicago Artist Coalition with Cosmopolitan Bank that September. They had 50 artists, some who were sort of really directly affected by the fire and others who weren't, create original works of art to be sold to just get some artists back on their feet. So there was definitely a common theme, and the theme of that benefit was regeneration.
The long term, when you think about what the arts community, the contemporary arts community and gallery community looks like today, what River North, the neighborhood, looks like today, you really can draw a line to what happened with this fire in 1989. How has the community changed when you look at it? I mean, River North still has art galleries. It may not be the same as it was, as you're talking about in the 80s, but it seems that there still is a presence in this neighborhood.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's the thing that people hold on to the most, is that's where things really got started. And, I mean, when I look at old copies of Chicago Gallery News, when it was first out, you know, there's a 1989 spring edition that has 65 galleries just located in River North. And then there's another 40 galleries in the magazine in, you know, around Michigan Avenue, Randolph Street, and sort of Old Town. But that's 65% of basically the galleries in there were all in one neighborhood within a couple blocks. Now, we still have over 100 galleries listed in CGN, you know, and on the website, but they're just more spread out.
Yeah.
And there's more in the suburbs, but there's a lot more in Westtown. But there was a migration from River North to the West Loop, and it's kind of gone to Westtown now. Like, there's always going to be a change. I think it just happened in a much more dramatic fashion because of the fire, and that was just a spreading out of the art community.
Yeah. Obviously, it's there's still a lot, and I think the conspiracy theories are interesting. You know, I'll say it if you won't, just this idea that there were a lot of people who wanted space in River North to create a neighborhood and high-priced housing and to regenerate a commercial and real estate or residential area. and art galleries got in the way. And
well,
I
it's
think
still
that
happening.
Yeah, but that seems to be the where the conspiracy theories are around how that fire started, especially since the fire department can't tell you how it got started.
It was inconclusive. They couldn't rule anything. Everybody had their own ideas, but it did clear out a desirable city block. And that was basically made desirable because of the galleries and the artists who were there, because they staked the territory first, which is sort of the natural path people usually say about gentrification is, you know, the artists and creatives go there first.
Yeah. Ginny Vanellier, she's the publisher of Chicago Gallery News. You can read this article and other great stuff about Chicago arts and the contemporary art scene here at chicagogallerynews.com. Ginny, thanks so much for coming in and talking about this story that happened 30 years ago in 1989 in River North. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Well, you can always find more on chicagogallerynews.com.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're sitting here in the basement of Thalia Hall in Pilsen, talking with Matt McCann and Jim Wilbur of Superchunk. Superchunk, one of the best bands to have played Chicago throughout the 30 years of your existence, and also here celebrating 25 years of the album Foolish. It's great to have you guys, and thanks for taking the time out today to talk with us.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Thank you.
So Chicago, just as, you know, think about 30 years of you guys playing all sorts of venues, from lounge acts to Metro. What comes to mind when you think about playing Chicago throughout your illustrious history?
Well, Chicago was one of the first cities we played outside of the East Coast, because the first real tour that we did, we came through here and we played at Czar Bar, a show Peter Margasak put on, and with Seaweed and Geek. And so I always think about that show just because it was amazing to be in the middle of the country where we had never traveled as a band, and there were people at the show. We just had a couple of singles out at the time. We didn't have an album out yet or anything. So ever since then, we've always had great shows here, you know, whether it was, like you were saying, Lounge Acts, Metro. This is our first visit to Thalia Hall, so we always have good shows.
And to think about the shows that I've been at, full crowds, sold out shows at Metro, and I think about the really when Foolish was coming out. Do you think about those days? Do you think back to those days of when the albums came out and the sort of the chaos and the crowds that surrounded the music and the bands at that time?
Thinking about it today, Jason on the drive here was asking me. I was giving him war stories of 1994, but another day, you gotta get up and face it.
Well,
another year,
you know, and playing the shows here. In addition to that, we also have made a couple records here. So we've spent more time in Chicago than a lot of other cities where we're literally there for one night or whatever. Right. So we have more friends here and just have spent more time in the city, which makes it feel more like a home away from home than some other places in the country where we've toured through but haven't spent as much time as we have here. And, yeah, even, you know, playing festivals, which can feel kind of impersonal, and you're in the middle of 100 other bands that are playing that weekend. You know, we've had great shows at Riot Fest or at street festivals that we've played here.
Yeah.
The show we played at Pitchfork was maybe the hottest show we've ever played.
Temperature-wise?
Temperature-wise. It was insane. But yeah, so there's a lot of memorable times that we've had in Chicago.
You know, for you guys to be celebrating not just your 30th birthday, but to have the 25th anniversary of Foolish, you guys put out the acoustic version of the record and redid the songs acoustically. Why do that? Why bring that style, that tone to that record?
Well, you've said this before. When Foolish came out, it seemed to some people like we were mellowing or like making quieter music, you know, or more nuanced or whatever you want to say. But to us, it was just like a rock record. And so, you know, there was like the thing about like re-recording it as, you know, this is what it would have been like if it was actually a quieter record rather than, you know.
Yeah.
And it's fun to do.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, we were trying to think of something to do for the Merge Records 30th anniversary. We did a subscription vinyl series. Trying to think of something interesting to do, and we've recorded a lot of acoustic versions of songs from all our records, really. But we'd never done something like a whole album. Like Jim was saying, Foolish kind of seemed to be the one that lent itself most to that treatment, since people kind of acted like it was
already a
real delicate record as it was. And I listened to the original album now, which we mixed here in Chicago at Steve Albini's studio, and it just sounds like a lot of our other records to me. But the acoustic version is legitimately different, I think. And we'd also never really made a record where pretty much what you hear is us playing the songs live in the studio, which is what, including the vocals on most of the songs. And then we obviously, when you hear it, overdub some strings that Owen Pallett played, and there's saxophone and piano and a couple other things, but the main tracks on the acoustic version of Foolish is just us playing the songs as a band, which is, again, when you've been a band for 30 years, you're always looking for kind of new, interesting things to do, you know?
Right. I guess a question about the lyrics, too, because, you know, as you go back and you redo these songs and you give a different arrangement and treatment to them, the lyrics do stand out. And to some
of
the fans...
A lot of people said, like, yeah, right. Wow, that's I finally know what these songs... what I've been singing along to all this time.
Right. But, I mean, for that, do the songs... Do you feel like they're as relevant as ever in 2019 than when you wrote the songs in 1994?
I don't know if they're as relevant to me, but it's taken out of the context of the time and out of the context of being kind of shouty rock music. I think in some ways they're more, the lyrics can be taken more universally about just how people relate to each other and how you make decisions about whether you hold a grudge or don't against someone,
right,
or how you move past a situation in your life or don't move past it, or why it's hard to do that. And so I think that it was kind of interesting having to like relearn the lyrics, because a lot of these songs we never played live, so I never had to sing them over and over again. So just trying to even like remember what some of them were, because there was no lyric sheet, it kind of did make me think about, like, is this even worth singing again, you know? But I think that, like I said, kind of putting it in a different context and removed from that time, it's kind of takes on a new meaning.
Did you change any of the lyrics?
I did not change any.
You kept them the same, huh?
Yeah. Really?
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We're in the green room at Thalia Hall down in Pilsen, talking with Superchunk. Mac and Jim are here. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mac and Jim from Superchunk in the green room at Thalia Hall. They're here. There was a great article Greg Codd just did in the Tribune, about, I think it was off the fact you guys are here, talking about protest music. He talked to a bunch of different people. And he talked to you, Mac, just about the idea of protest music, really talking about the last album you guys had. It took me a second to be, oh, is Superchunk a protest band? And it took me a second to be like, I'm not sure, but the more I hear the music and the more that I rethink my thought of Superchunk, you are. So do you see yourselves that way, that you guys are a little bit more anti-establishment protest music of this time?
I guess I never thought of ourselves as a protest band, because I don't think that we're just one type of band, and I feel like the songs have always just kind of been a product of what was going on with us at any given time, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that, for instance, Here's to Shutting Up, a lot of that music is about the kind of early Bush era, that period in politics, but it's also kind of about capitalism and being on tour when you're a certain age and other things too, so there's nothing that explicit. Whereas I feel like the new record is easier to talk about as protest music because of the times that we're living in now,
right,
which seem much more dire on a lot of fronts. And they were also written in a much shorter time period around the election in 2016, just before and just after. And with the decision to kind of be like, okay, like this is what this record is about. It would be weird to make a record now and not talk about these things because everyone's living through this.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I think that I don't know if you would listen to No Pocky for Kitty and say it's a protest record, because I think when you're 22 or whatever, you're living a different kind of life than you are now.
Else,
and,
right.
And, well, I think we all grew up listening to protest music in the form of punk rock and hardcore.
Right.
So that's definitely always been in the mix of what we're doing.
I think about you guys, and you know, this being your 30th anniversary, and you don't miss a beat. It just seems like every time you look up, you guys are making new music. And I know there was a hiatus in there, but you're still, you know, as relevant today that you were in, when Foolish came out in 1994. Does your audience expect the same? Does your audience, as I would assume they get older, just as you do, and a lot of, I think of myself as a Superchunk fan, do they expect that from you, or do they evolve? Do their tastes evolve as well?
I think that's true. I think there's just a mutual respect. You know, there's not, and we never sat down and had a discussion about, like, a game plan about how to, like, further our career or anything. It's really more been a very organic element of our lives. Like, mm-hmm. just being a member of the band is just part of, like, it's like being part of a family or something. And I put fans in quote because they're kind of like, we wouldn't be here without them, you know what I mean? It's all, it's, there's a sense of community about it all, to a degree. And it may sound a little, like, you know, hippy-dippy, but it's sort of true, I think, for us.
I think that's what everybody's looking for with their music or their art, is to be a part of a community, yeah.
It's not really expectations, it's a sort of mutual respect.
But I think expectations play a role in the sense that we're all fans of bands that have been around for a long time, in addition to new bands. But so I think that as artists, we have in mind what we look for in the artists that we like or have liked for a long time. And think about, for instance, when we started making new records again in 2010 after 9 years off, I think that it was definitely on our mind that you don't want to wait that long and then make a new record and then have people think like, well, why did they why'd they bother making this after all that time? You know,
right.
Like you want to be,
right.
You want to, each time you make a record, especially when you're in a position which we're lucky to be in, which is that we're not on this cycle of album, tour for 2 years, album, tour for 2 years. That's just not where we are. So it's a choice of ours to make a new record each time. It's not a necessity. So if you're going to make that choice, I feel like you have to be intentional about what you're doing. And again, if you're a fan of a band that's been around this long, in some ways you could be expecting a letdown each time, you know, on
the
12th, 13th album that a band is doing, you know. And so it's kind of a challenge in a way that's enjoyable to defy expectations about what the next Superchunk record is going to be.
You guys all of the members of Superchunk, you have side projects and other jobs and things going on where, but you don't need to be Superchunk. You have, everyone's got your name now. Why do you keep coming back? What is it about the band and this arrangement and the fact that you guys have been working together for 30 years that keeps you coming back?
Chemistry.
I mean, it's fun, and we're musicians, and if you're a musician and you've been doing it this long, unless you just decide to actively get out of it, this is what you're doing, you know what I mean? And I think that if and when Superchunk's not active, you know, I would still be writing songs and making music, you know, but if we're going to do it as Superchunk, we try to do it in a real way that means the shows are going to be good and the records are going to be good and that it's fun for us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because we're not just making product, but into a pipeline.
And that's what I think everyone that I know that listens to you guys is attracted to, the independent part of it. You're not a commodity. It's not, you found a hook, you're going to do this thing for the next 15 years and make as much money as you possibly can. That's never been your ethos, even when you guys were the indie rockers of the early 90s. Is there ever a time when you're like, okay, man, I wish we would have taken a different course. I wish we would have got that dance track.
And we would just... I'm still working on the dance track.
Had a mountain of money to slide down in
I guess what does it mean to be independent, like, in 2019? What does it mean to think about what you're heading out to do, and are you accomplishing it 30 years later?
What comes to my mind as someone who also has a record label is that the landscape, as far as how people listen to music and stuff, means that anyone can be independent, literally as independent as they want, like independent, like they're just themselves putting a track up on their SoundCloud or on all the digital service providers that they have access to, you know. So I don't know if you're an artist starting out now, if that independence really means the same thing as it did when we started, and it felt much more like you're making a choice. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So, I don't know. For us,
it was almost an ethical decision.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Now it might make more sense, you know, for some people to be independent.
Maybe that's why.
I mean, right here in Chicago, you've got Chance the Rapper, who's like a great example of someone who's completely independent and hugely successful and making great music, and that would have been a really difficult thing to do in 1989, you know.
And I think about you guys with Merge, of course, being one of the instrumental record labels of our time when it comes to indie rock music and all the bands that have been on Merge. And then I think of you guys as well, starting out in 89 and being influenced by punk rock and everything that was happening there, but really, truly being the forefathers of an indie rock movement in this country. Do you see it that way? I mean, as someone who's celebrating your 30th anniversary, that you are almost pioneers in a way, and that you have something to maybe pass on to the next generation?
I don't really see it that way, simply because I felt like we were just coming in the middle of a continuum.
Yeah.
From independent labels that have been around since the 70s and early 80s, punk labels, alternative rock labels that had started then, and we were just kind of like looking at other people that were already doing things like Sub Pop or K or Team Beat or Discord,
right?
And then kind of figuring out how they did it and taking some stuff from them and then doing our own thing in that way. And then, you know, we couldn't have become what we became without Touch and Go, Chicago independent label that really helped Merge grow and become what we are. So I didn't see us as really pioneering so much as kind of seeing how other people were doing it and figuring out our own way to kind of do it as well. Yeah. You know,
as you celebrate, and we'll wrap it up here, but you know, celebrate this tour and the fact that this summer, you know, you guys are celebrating 30 years. Do you reflect on that? Do you reflect, Jim, and say, I can't believe I've been in this band for 30 years?
Yeah, you're asking the wrong guy in the band, probably, because I think about it, but I don't dwell on it. I really do try to like go, you know, one step at a time. So, and like I said before, we don't make plans, and so it's like not making plans also kind of goes backwards too. You don't second guess yourself too much, or you shouldn't.
I mean, I think that what's gratifying about being around this long is kind of the accumulation of relationships and experiences, and like the artists that we get to work with on Merge, and again coming through a town like Chicago where we've played so many shows and know so many people, and getting to play a place we haven't played before on a new record.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's great to get to add to the stuff that you've already done, and I think it's gonna be fun and fulfilling as long as like we're still kind of like adding to what we've done as opposed to repeating something, you know.
Well, Mac, Jim, thank from Superchunk here in Chicago. We're down in the basement of Thalia Hall in Pilsen. I can't thank you guys enough for taking some time out. Have a great
show.
Thanks
a lot. Looking forward to it.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. The documentary Maiden is coming to Chicago theaters next month. It's the groundbreaking story of Tracy Edwards and her all-female crew aboard the Maiden in the 1989 Whitbread Round the World yacht race.
For me, sailing was about freedom. It was freedom of everything. It was leaving everything behind. My father died when I was 10. My parents instilled in me a sense of determination.
So when I heard about
the Whitbread Round the World race, it was just something I had to do. Sailing at that time was very male-dominated. There were just no women anywhere in it.
The Whitbread Round the World race at 33,000 miles is the longest and most challenging on Earth.
I wanted to be part of this. I remember going to the skipper and he went, "We're not going to be the only racing team in the world with a girl." And that's when I made the decision to put an all-female crew into the race.
The film looks not only at that legendary moment, but also captures how the sailing community was not immune to sexism and misogyny. The guys didn't even try to hide it. But Tracy was determined, and she persevered, and she made history. The film uses footage from the actual race in 1989, everything from navigating the frigid and dangerous South Seas to the infamous moment where the crew sailed into Fort Lauderdale wearing bathing suits. Paparazzi had a field day with that, and that photo became one of the most popular of its time. But this is not a film that just celebrates pop culture moments. It shows a crew of young women coming together to not only take on the grueling task of sailing around the world, but they changed the sport forever. The skipper and star of this film, Tracy Edwards, my guest tonight on Extension 720. Tracy, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
This film, and I really, really enjoyed it, and I love being able to see the footage from 1989. Where does it come from? Was the goal always to make a film of this experience?
No, it really wasn't. Looking back, I don't know what we thought would happen to the footage. So I did the H5-86 race, and there's no record of it whatsoever. I had a little Instamatic, I took a couple of pictures, and that was about it. But the race committee at the time said, look, we'd like volunteers to take cameras on the boats, these newfangled cameras that you can, movie things that you can take on the boats. And of course, all the guys went, oh, no, we're far too serious and competitive to take cameras. And we went, we will. So they gave us a camera and we said, well, who's going to film? And Joe the cook said, well, I'm not doing a watch, so I'll film. So we sent her to the BBC for 4 days training. 4 days. And then she came back with this huge camera, which was almost bigger than her. Joe's not the biggest person in the world, but I think the really great thing we did before we left is we practiced. And what the guys did was they threw the cameras on the boat and they said, we'll deal with that later. But we practiced.
And it shows.
Oh my God.
Makes the film. The film is great and the narrative arc is great and it's really, truly a great documentary.
Well, that's down to Joe.
But the footage, being able to see how the crew reacted when you're sailing, when you're going the southernmost route in the South Seas, this moment where no one gets to see this stuff. And then to be able to see it, it was really breathtaking.
I think the great thing that Joe has is she has this amazing emotional intelligence. And the difference between the male interviews and the female footage was that all the stuff from the men's boats, because Alex took 2 years to find this footage. It was lost to the four winds. It was everywhere. And he said, they did find some stuff from the guys' boats, and it's very much, here we are, we're doing 12 right. knots, and it is day 12. And what Joe did was she just filmed us. Mm-hmm. And, I have to say that we did tell her to go away at some point when she had the camera in our face. But then I think she learned how to film subtly. We didn't notice we were being filmed.
Well, it's obvious. There's some great footage of you when you're in the navigation room and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do. And you can see just the insecurity of the whole thing, of you telling your story 30 years later in this documentary and seeing how 30 years ago you are reacting in the actual footage. It really makes you, not too many chances in our lifetime to have that kind of experience.
Oh, I think it's pretty unique. And I think the really skillful thing that Alex did was, even though he'd found all the footage by the time he interviewed us, he didn't let us watch it. And so he didn't prime us at all. He just relied on our memories. And what he said afterwards was, he said, I have never found such a collective group of memories that are pretty much all the same, and that we all remember. We have different perspectives, sure, obviously, because
you know, you've got the sailmaker thinking, don't break my sails. And then I'm thinking, please go in the right direction. And so we're all thinking of things from different points of view. But he said, factually, we had this astonishing recall. And none of us thought we would have. I mean, we all said to Alex, I'm so sorry, but I don't think I remember that much. You know, 2 days later, I crawled out of that, you know, sort of studio going, I didn't realize I knew that much about what we'd done.
Well, to think about this being the 30-year anniversary of that race and the first all-female crew to go around the world in this race. Obviously, those memories are going to be strong for you because it was a big moment in your life, and there are parts in this film that you see how big of a moment it was for racing and for sailing, and just the end of the film when you see how people react to you guys coming in, not to give it away, but people remember in history. But there seems to be... You've lived this your entire life for 30 years. Is it an easy story to recall for you? Or when you got in the studio and you started talking to Alex, was it difficult to get the moments out?
Well, that's the interesting thing, you see, because Maiden has been a huge part of my life, and that I went on to do other all-female crews and the world's first mixed gender team and lots of other things. But Maiden is kind of the thing that created me as a person. And I thought I pretty much knew the whole story in my head. But when he really started to drill down and eke out the information out of me, I got a lot more emotional than I thought I was going to during the interview. In fact, I think I cried a number of times. But I think what he got to with all of us was how we did feel at the time. And none of us, I thought, really remembered that. And I was quite surprised when I admitted at how worried and scared and anxious I was. You know, I would never have admitted that at the time. Mm-hmm. And if you'd interviewed me straight afterward, I said, no, I would have said absolutely confident, always thought we could do it. And of course, I didn't always think we could do it. And that is the beauty, I think, of doing something that specific length of time after. And he did say 25 years after something is a great time to interview people because they've got stuff in their brain that they don't know and they're much more honest.
And they're also reflective of what they accomplished. For you, to look back at yourself in the film and to recognize the severity or just the avalanche that is the amount of press and the whole sailing community really putting their eyes, just focusing solely on you and the first all-female crew. When you see that footage, do you feel that pressure? Do you remember that pressure and what that was like?
I do. I think what surprised me, and actually we all said this, we all watched it together for the first time in June last year at BAFTA with a very nervous Alex Holmes hovering around in the background. And all of us said, I don't remember myself being like that. That's me. And for me, watching myself being so calm and eloquent about the project, I remember myself as being a bit of an idiot, a bit of a twit, you know, sort of just lurching from one situation to the next, rambling on. But I'm looking at that stuff and I'm thinking, wow, you were, for that age, actually quite together. And I don't remember myself being like that. But I do know that what was going on beneath that surface was turmoil and worry and doubt and fear and all the other things. And that's been really weird for me to watch, I have to say.
When you look back on it too, the misogyny and the sexism, which was a big part, and you knew it at the time. There was even the swimsuit picture was what kind of fed into that. But to have the ability to look back 30 years and to recognize how serious those issues are to us now in 2019 and how maybe they weren't as serious back in 1989, did you recognize what was happening? Did you recognize that this was almost more of an obstacle than the race itself?
I think when I first wanted to do an all-female crew, I mean, I wanted to do it for quite selfish reasons. I wanted to navigate on a round-the-world race boat. So I actually created this project for me to be a navigator. And I knew people would say, oh, you can't do it. And that was fine. I expected that. What I didn't expect was this vociferous, can't do this, you shouldn't do this, you will die. Not you might die, but you will die. So this outpouring of anger almost, mm-hmm. That surprised me. That's when I realized that, okay, I'm not doing this just to be a navigator, I'm doing this for women, for all women, we've got a battle to fight here. I didn't know we had a battle to fight here. But I think when we all realized that, we all jumped in with both feet, you know, we absolutely tackled it full on. But I think, okay, we had to fight to get to the start line, but that battle brought us together as a crew. So when we crossed that start line, we were already battle hardened. You know, we were ready to go out and, you know, get out there and do it.
Yeah, because the announcement for the race was a year or so, a couple years, right? So there was all sorts of press and all sorts of people saying, you can't do it. What are you doing? You can't do this. You can't find a boat. You can't get a sponsor. All that kind of stuff. So by the time the race happened, you had already gone through it all.
We had. And the thing is, I think we didn't let it get us down, and we didn't actually listen to it that much. It was white noise. We sort of put that in the background there because it's not important what other people think of us. Only the people that we care about, that's important. And I think, you know, that I distinctly remember these guys getting onto their brand new, sleeky, shiny racing yachts with their brand new crew gear, you know. And they'd literally turned up the day before with their bags and they get on this boat. And I'm thinking, how can you feel the way we feel about this race, you know? And so this disadvantage turned into a massive advantage. And people say, you know, there were only two crews that stayed together the whole way round. Steinlager, who won, and we came second. And that says all I think you need to know about this comradeship and this bond that you build beforehand.
It's great because in the film, it's a moment that obviously is really big in your life. And it's a big moment for sport and sailing as well. But it's also, I found myself, I was probably 15 at the time, an American kid living in Chicago. Not really paying attention to it, right? Not something that I kept getting mad at myself watching this film, saying, why am I not having recall to this story in America? This is an amazing story. And there was the Fort Lauderdale photo and Florida and the whole bit. But do you see it that way? Do you see it that there was obviously an intense moment for you and the sailing community and obviously the European countries involved, but that there was a whole big part of the world that wasn't paying attention?
I think that we had a brief moment when everyone went, oh, and then everyone went back to what they were doing. What I do think that we all took away from that was we all had to continue the fight, and we all did in our different ways. You know, I went on to do other projects. Dawn Riley, who is American from New York, she went on to do the first all-female America's Cup team and whipped Ted Turner.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and Dennis Connor. Woo! So, you know, we carried the battle quietly with us for the rest of our lives, and we continue.
What is the key? What is the key to being a great sailor when it comes to this race? Why have you had success over and over in your career where others who men or women who have tried things haven't?
I think that, okay, so I'm not a great sailor.
Great navigator? What would you call it?
I think I'm a good navigator. I'm an average sailor. I have to work quite hard at being a good sailor. And I think that's actually my best quality because I understand my limitations. And someone once said to me, you know, when you're putting a team together, make sure you're the most stupid person in the room. And that's what I did. I picked people who were much better than me. And then I think, you know, there's also especially when you're sailing, you have a democracy on the boat where you're putting in your input and thoughts and opinions, you're training, you're sailing. But when you cross the start line, it's a dictatorship. There is one person on the boat who gives the orders, and that's me, and that's it.
Is that hard to do when you surround yourself with people that are better than you?
No. If you invited these amazing people on the boat and said, right, you're going to do it my way, they wouldn't listen to you. And what we used to do, which no other male team did, was we would, when we had a team meeting, we would have different chairs of the meeting because we need to see the project from different points of view. So, you know, when Dawn was chairing the meeting and she's in charge of the water maker and the generator and the engine, she has certain, you know, sort of criteria.
Yeah.
When Tanya, who's in charge of the sales, runs the meeting, we're all thinking about things from her point of view and, well, I didn't think about that before. And, you know, so that worked like an absolute dream. So we all owned our different areas. We knew we'd all been listened to. Then when you cross the start line, you know that your input's in there somewhere, and every decision hopefully your skipper is going to make, which is me, is going to be the right one because I've been given all the right information.
I would be remiss not to ask about the South Seas. The footage in the trip from Uruguay to Australia, and you have to go pretty much through the Antarctic.
Yeah.
The footage is intense. Those waves look like, I don't even want to go near that stuff. I mean, it scares the living bejesus out of everybody. To be in that situation, to be in a race and to be in that sea for the first time, what are your memories of that? Beyond the film, but just that harrowing experience of facing life and death in the face.
Well, it's all about being human, really, and what human beings are capable of, because you don't just suddenly go from one ocean to another ocean. You start to experience, you know, so you go through the roaring 40s and, you know, the raging 50s and the screaming 60s before you get to the absolutely terrifying 70s. And so you are almost building up your immune system. And if you drop someone into the Southern Ocean, then they die of fear. But you get this opportunity to sort of, and every day, something that you would have found scary, you go, okay, that's a 30-foot wave. That's fine. I can deal with that. And the wind speed goes up and up and up, and you just become part of your environment. Before you know it, you are totally in your, you're entrenched, you're engrossed in what you're doing. And yes, you have moments of fear. But interestingly, I had more moments of fear on Atlantic Privateer when I was the cook and surrounded by actually probably the best sailors in the world, because they are mavericks and they're pushing the envelope. And I know that there's an element of them that, you know, at one point we had the skipper standing up at the mast with a flare gun because we hadn't taken the spinnaker down in time, and he's going to shoot the spinnaker out if it gets too scary. And I'm like, oh my, what am I doing here?
Maybe there's a little bit of your maverick from that experience, even though you know, obviously much more buttoned up and professional, but you were a maverick in how you won that leg.
I think I was a risk taker. But then I'd learned from Atlantic Privateer, you choose your battles to fight and you choose the risks to take. So I wouldn't keep a spinnaker up that long. If we broach, I'm going to break something. If I break something, I'm going to not win the race. You know, so that's no good. But then I do think of the conversation about the icebergs, which now, I mean, just make me want to die, where we went, so what do you think the statistics are of hitting an iceberg? And I remember the conversation so clearly, and someone went, well, you know, if we were looking for an iceberg in the Southern Ocean, we wouldn't be able to find it. So I'm thinking it's like really a lot that you wouldn't bump into an iceberg. And I'm going, yeah, I think that's what, should we just go for it? And everyone went, yeah, let's just go for it. So that was our risk assessment.
Unbelievable. My final question for you, just as you know, as you say as a young Tracy in the film, that you're not a feminist, you know, that was a big part where you said, this is not something, I'm not a feminist, I'm not into feminism, I just want to equal shot at this. The Tracy now, do you agree with that sentiment? Do you agree with this from the Tracy in 1989?
No, I think that was a coward's reply. But then I was 23 years old, and feminism had such an awful, horrible connotation at that time. And I just want to be liked when I'm 23 years old. Please don't not like me. But now, the older you, I don't care what people think of you. What I do think is that there are so many younger women that don't have a voice. You know, I'm an old fart now. I can say what I like. And because of what I've done, people listen to me. So I think it is my absolute responsibility to be a feminist and to speak up and to shout out and to say to all the things that younger women who maybe are still in an environment where they can't speak up, you know, so I speak for them.
A fantastic film. The new documentary is called Maiden. It comes to Chicago theaters next month. It's about the all-female crew led by Tracy Edwards, the Maiden, in the 1989 Whitbread Round the World Yacht Race. Tracy, a pleasure to have you here. It's a great film, and thank you for joining
us
tonight.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. We'll keep you up to date on all the weather as the severe weather comes through the area. Heads out in Lake Michigan, but we'll continue to keep you updated on all of the reports and of course, the advisories and warnings that are happening in the Chicago area. Well, we've been talking about 1989. We talked about art tonight. We talked about music and culture. So let's move on to theater. In 1989, Chicago was home to theater companies like Steppenwolf and Goodman and Chicago Shakespeare, but the off-loop theater scene, much smaller than it is today. But something magical was happening in Lakeview along the Belmont and Clark area. Small theater companies were popping up doing alternative theater, late-night comedy, poetry slams, places like Café Voltaire, the Annoyance Theater, and my guest tonight, the Neo-Futurists. The Neo-Futurists are celebrating their 30th year in Chicago. The company is one of the most successful theater companies in the country. They've sold out shows for years with lines around the block wherever they played, whether it was at the Live Bait Theater back in the early 90s or, of course, at the Neo Futurarium, their current home in Andersonville. They continue with the longest-running late-night show in Chicago, Infinite Wrench, which was formerly known as Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. The Neos just made news with the addition to their leadership team, Jorge Silva. Silva comes from the Goodman Theater and will take over as managing director. He joins longtime artistic director Kurt Chang. Both are here tonight in studio, Jorge and Kurt, and one of the original Neo-Futurists, Phil Ritterelli, in studio as well. Guys, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Hey, Justin. Good. Happy to be here. Thanks.
Hello.
So let's start, Jorge. Welcome to the team. Let me just start with you. Why make the move from the Goodman Theater to the Neo-Futurists?
It was a really obvious move for me. The company has been a part of my theater education for a long, long time. you talking about how it's been around for a while, but it brought me in at an early age when I was just beginning to get a feel for what theater meant. And when I came back to Chicago recently, I decided, I saw them on stage. I was like, oh, I could do that. I could do that now. Now that I have the theater degree that I'll never do anything with, I could do that stuff that they're doing on stage. And, I started out as a student getting the scholarship. Then they brought me back for a few shows. Then I got to do a prime time recently as a lighting designer, put that lighting design degree to use. And when the opportunity came to support them in this much, much bigger way, it was crystal clear. I had to jump ship.
Well, Kurt, there's so many people who are your peers, but also people who have come through the doors there that probably have very similar stories of Jorge's. This idea that, you know, they came there as young people, yeah, and students and others, and said, this blows my mind. This is theater. This is what I know. That has to continue to happen at the Neo Futurist.
Yeah, I think I like to talk about everyone that's invested there from a leadership level, which is basically the entire company, to a volunteer level, to associate level. Everyone goes about the work with a fan mentality. Like, we love it. We love it at a level where it's hitting us in the heart, and we get the opportunity, because we have various special skills that will throw us into the thing to do it and lead the charge for right. What it was always meant to be and continues to be.
You know, Phil, it's amazing to hear the young leadership at Neo Futurist talk about the love of the stage, but also the love of the company. What's that mean to you to be one of the original Neo Futurists back from 1989?
Yeah, oh, it's fantastic. I mean, I can't jump for numbers the way I used to, but I think that's kind of the point. Is we all maintain a relationship with the company, and our relationship to and the way we support it just evolves. I'm on the board now, and there are other things I can do to help support the different types of productions and classes and touring and everything that, the scholarships that we provide. So it's pretty fantastic. What's really great is going back to see the performances and see the same sort of techniques being applied to different topics, current events, and things that are on the mind of the folks that are in the ensemble today,
Phil, take us back. 1989. I kind of talk about take us back. So, this idea of something special happening, because there was a lot going on in Chicago, and we already talked about the arts and music and things like that. But in the theater community, it seems that one time in 1989, yeah, there was something special in the water that was happening, especially in Lakeview.
I think a lot of people were just at this point. I know I was personally, like you said, you got the theater degree, and I've done classically trained at a conservatory, and I've done improv, and what else is there? And here was a company that was writing and creating their own work, and it was spontaneous, but it wasn't improvised, and so that was really attractive. And right around the corner, The Annoyance was doing co-ed prison sluts, I think was their among the first. And you still had an opportunity to be connected to the artist who inspired you in the city, but it was you weren't trapped in that sort of traditional actor route of, I have to get my headshot, go to an audition, go to the generals and do that. And, this was something we could make that was personal. And it was fun. We had an opportunity to create personal relationships with the audience members who kept coming back and back.
And there's something special about that concept, the concept that it almost was an alternative to a theater scene at the time that was very formal. And I don't mean that theater is formal. I mean that headshots and you have to go in for auditions, this is when you do it. There was a different kind of vibe to what Neo Futurists are doing, what Annoyance are doing. It seemed to be more organic. How do you keep that spirit, Kurt? How do you keep that as you guys get bigger and you now have an ensemble and a board and everything in between that Phil and the rest of his colleagues could never have dreamt of? How do you keep that spirit organic?
Well, I think so. We're a theater that's guided by a way of doing the stuff that we make, the aesthetic of neo-futurism, where the primary thing is that we're ourselves on stage. We bring everything, all the content we bring and the stories we bring is from ourselves. And the primary goal is to make something happen in the room. And to me, that translates as making good theater. And for those, I think a huge reason that a lot of us get there is because we're disillusioned by, like, I don't know, certain, like, route mm-hmm. ways of making theater.
Absolutely.
And that continues. The way that Phil just talked about, like, what a headshot is and, like, a relationship to a headshot was a very similar experience I had.
Well, there's this punk rock DIY kind of vibe that the neo-futurists perfected for years, and you continue to do it. Jorge, you come from downtown theater. Downtown theater. you come up to... is there going to be a learning curve in that regard? You know, when Kurt says, you know, enough of the headshots, man, let's just get some... Then you're like, no, this is how we do it downtown. I mean, how do you adjust to fit to the ethos that we're talking about here?
Well, you may be talking about downtown theater, but I'm Southside, so... I've already come, like, somewhat out of place being a Southsider, being a Chicagoan in theater at all, especially at places that, you know, are considered top-tier echelon theaters. So it's not really much of a change to say, like, I'm going to be out of place for a little bit, right? And adapt. And I think there's something that could be helped there. Like, there's a melding there that happens. Like, I feel like I could bring all these skills that I know have worked at other bigger places and help build the company that much more. But again, you know, I'm coming from off the beaten path. So, and I'm glad about that. That's what brought me to the neo-futurist, the unconventional style.
The style back in 1989, and I remember when I was first introduced to the neo-futurist, 1993, 1994, sitting on the floor, rolling a die to get in, the whole bit where you were just like, this is finally something in the city that at the age of 18 or 19, whatever I was for me. Mm-hmm. It was designed for me. This was not sort of sneaking into a bar and hoping that nobody checked my ID. This was not, this is a theater and I'm just glad to be in it. You know, I should keep my mouth shut, no hard candy. Like, this was for me. How do you keep, as younger people discover your theater and continue to, is that the idea that you continue to play to that 18-year-old kid who's like, I haven't found my niche yet, but I can find it at the Neo Futurist?
I think, like... The ensemble in the Infinite Wrench is often around the younger side, I suppose. But I wouldn't say, our target audience is less about like an age demographic or any kind of like identifying a demographic, rather like anyone that like wants to run into each other inside of a room. Learning about the theater, I've heard a lot of stories and continue to hear from fans about the theater being a place that they can go, specifically high schoolers.
Yeah.
You know, it's a place that we're not serving alcohol. It's a late night place that people can go see a thing happen and then go home like safely. That's like a huge part of the younger audience.
That is such a, what Kurt just said is so important. Right, the idea that there's a place for younger people. I'm not talking about 12-year-olds. You're talking about 18, 19, 17, 16, whatever it might be in that regard to go and feel like they're welcome and get great art.
Because the ensemble is creating stories based on themselves, and they're being honest and they're dealing with the stuff that goes on in their life. The audience recognizes that, and it's the artists reflect. The audience reflects who the people are they're in the room listening to. It's the thing what you talked about, it's supposed to be affordable, it's supposed to be accessible, there aren't supposed to be borders and obstacles to being involved. It's inviting. None of those things have changed, and the people, even I think the makeup of the ensemble is very similar to when we first started performing. We were songwriters and comedians and improvisers and actors, formal actors. We were dancers. We were poets, and in that way, we embraced a lot of different medium to communicate these stories.
Yeah.
And I just think that just makes it more and more accessible for a younger audience.
You guys, with the Infinite Wrench continuing to be a success, and obviously what you continue to do with the primetime programming, you've got big shows this weekend for Pride. That's always a big thing at the Neo Futurist. Talk about that.
Yeah. So starting tomorrow, we're doing The Infinite Wrench, 30 queer plays in 60 straight minutes, which we've done an iteration of ever since 1989. I believe Dave All may have kicked off the first one.
Yeah, it's a it's a huge event for us internally. Everyone looks forward to it. It's just, it's a really great opportunity to find. We've been having a sponsor set for a number of years now.
Yeah. Well, and so every Thursday night is all the proceeds are 100% dedicated to a beneficiary of that year. This year, it's the Transformative Justice Law Project of Illinois, which provides radical justice services for transgender people and non-binary people. A great organization that serves Chicago and outside Illinois. So it's this time that we get to celebrate our own company members that align with LGBTQ plus folk, our audiences, our volunteers. It sells out very quickly because,
it's
about
a great tradition, 30 years of it.
And you're talking about like a theater that's speaking to like people that don't usually have it, young people. That also includes like LGBTQ plus folk as well. Like we're the hotbed for it in a lot of different ways, you know.
Jorge, for you, I'll give you the last word. Just as you think about the lineage and the 30-year history of this company, to join it, do you see right away ways that you can improve it, number one? But number two, is there a way, just from your vantage point from being at the Goodman but also at Near Futurist, that something like this could happen again? Like thinking of Phil and the guys back in 1989 deciding to put on a show at Stage Left or Live Bait and creating this kind of following. Is that something that can happen in Chicago again?
That's a last word question? Oh, wow. Okay. That's like, I feel like I got to write a thesis before I can give you that answer, but I'm going to try.
It is Extension 720.
I'll try. I think there's a big desire for theater to speak more than one dialect, right? I feel like we think about theater, we talk about theater, and this is what I mean by being a Southsider, is like there's a thought about what theater should be, and the Near Futurists aren't it, and that's what's great about it. And I feel like there's more and more communities that are leaning towards an unconventional theater because the language of theater has to change along with the changing demographics of theater. And that only means it's becoming more and more democratic, you know, for lack of a better term, right? And so, there's somebody did ask me, do you feel intimidated by the fact that the company is 30 years old? Is the institution bigger than the individual at that point? And that's a question I'm still grappling with. But certainly there are certain things I want to see happen, I want to see through, but it's only the things that I've already seen in the company before. And that's the inclusivity. And I want to build on that, grow on that. And we like to celebrate Latinx playwrights and performers, and that's great, we should. But I also want to celebrate all the other people that are working on this. And that's an ensemble of authors. And that's the administrators that we're working with and the people and the community partners, right? They're all making the theater together. So I think it's only a matter of building upon what has already there.
Great answer. Great final thought.
Thank you.
Jorge Silva
is
the managing director, the new managing director of the Neo Futurist. Kurt Cheng is here as well, the artistic director. And Phil Ritterelli, one of the original ensemble members and now board member of the Neo Futurist. We're talking about their start back in.
Still ensemble.
1989, the year that the company was born. Thanks, guys, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Once upon a time, there was a boy on the west side, strolling the streets looking for beats. Soundtrack of the west side sounded like loose squares, loose squares, loose squares.
The block was burning like a scorched savannah. We getting watched by them circular cameras. Big bruh be paranoid, blaming black clairvoyant joy. Stashed in a stash house, broken glass. Be our shield boy, open flash for the handoff. Like Maurice Grease and Cocoa Butter. We slick and everlasting, keep the casket tilting, fill it with 40 ounces of magic. We keeping it bold, you thinking we taking advantage. We cause effect, the targeted voices you typically slander. We infinite souls, so why you making us panda? You keep the history untold, but yo, we speak it in tandem. It's just for us, for us, for us. Like all them hustlers knew, just walking the block and talking to you. We sell you a secret just to get through. We calming your nerves like Lucy's do. Wisdom we plucking like juicy fruit. Passing it down to our youthful troops. Try to take a bite, just might lose your tooth. It burning your chest like Lucy's do. Your fragility telling my truth. Honest abilities never get used. Perfecting my imagery, master my tools. It give me that rush like Lucy's do. Respecting the heritage you never knew. We speaking in languages intention and true. We leaving the pack, just spreading our roots like Lucy's do, like Lucy's do. The porch was shaking after heaven vanished. We getting stopped cause they thinking we planned it. Big bruh be paranoid, blaming black clairvoyant joy. Tucked in our ankle socks, pad is down for the power play. Round us up like we livestock. Them white hoodies be undercover. The twisted whips a mass, it keeps the casket tilting, fill it with 40 ounces of static. We keeping it bold, you thinking we going on tangents. We architect the marvelous corners you taking for granted. We murals of joy, so why you painting us tragic? For us, the struggle's a beautiful toy. We keeping it deep in the attic. It's just for us, for us, for us. Like all them hustlers new, just walking the block and talking to you. We sell you a secret just to get through. We calming your nerves like Lucy's do. Wisdom we plucking like juicy fruit. Passing it down to why you food troops. Try to take a bite, just might lose your tooth. They're burning your chest like Lucy's do. Your fragility, telling my truth. Honest abilities never get used. Perfecting my imagery, master my tools. They give me that rush like Lucy's do. Respecting the heritage you never knew. We speaking in languages ancient and true. We leaving the pack and spreading our roots like Lucy's do, like Lucy's do. Loose squares, loose squares, loose squares. Our stories permeate the city, but do you care? Ignoring glorious vibes, essential oils to face today. Chicago loyal ain't here to play. Anoint the royal with truth to say. Black as southern nights, we flood the corners. Take a life, we owe the mourners. Sacrifice, we got tradition. Fear no fight. Listen, listen, check the mic. There's no division, so despite what you be witnessing, we tight, we black, we float like satellite. The city here is my birthright. West to south, we got the mic to take it from you like tonight. But yo, that war we won't ignite. We here for us, and that's alright. Take the lesson, we unite, and under stress, we prophesy. Create the culture, multiply. We on the train, we in the sky. Our black is bold, can never die. It's just for us, for us, for us, for us, for us.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Well, in studio, West Side rapper, hip-hop artist, poet, actor, Michael DeVille. A new album is out. It's called Maintain. He's going to be at the Logan Arts Festival coming up there this weekend, as well as other dates here this summer. Michael, great to have you back. And the performance, just great. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me, man.
It's been about 2 years. I looked it up. So we talked probably in 2017, yeah. And you came on, and we talked a lot about your career and about the transition from being an actor to being an artist. And you know, as you think about even just 2 years since we've talked and with this record, how do you think your music has evolved? How have you evolved from we sat down in 2017 to what you're producing now in 2019?
Yeah, man, I think just life experience, and you know, I'm learning how to create from a place of just happiness instead of creating from a place of trauma. This world is so traumatic. Every day I wake up and it's something else. And it can really affect your art. As an artist, you just feel like, you know, one of the most sensitive creatures on the planet. And so, you know, you receive all of that stimuli. And I go back and I listen to those old tapes. And I realize how frustrated I was and how bad things were going. And I was writing out of a sense of like freedom from that. And so the biggest challenge in my music since then is now that, you know, I'm growing up a little bit and I'm living where I want to live and with the person I want to be with, creating the music I want to create. How do you continue to stay inspired? You know, and so that's what this record and my previous record, Peace Fam, is really kind of trying to figure out. How do you find peace in a time where the world is like kind of falling apart?
I mean, that is everything about maturing, right? This idea that you now have so many different ways that you can evolve, whether it be just in your life and whether your music, your art, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
How does that play out for you? What does it mean to have that space, to both the mental space and the physical space, to create your art?
I mean, it means being really intentional with your energy and your time and your space, collaborating as much as possible, talking to other creatives and talking to non-creatives, and really looking at the world from, at the very best, when you're first starting to write, I believe, is just like kind of an objective standpoint, just seeing the things that are happening, and then you kind of take it personal. And like on this newest record, I tried to be a little bit more general in the sense of I wanted to speak to as many people as possible, specifically as many black people as possible, about the experience of being black in a country that feels like it's hunting you. That's always been kind of my MO. But now that I'm older, I'm 30 now, I kind of understand, you know, there's also happiness. There's also joy. There's also love. There's also these really beautiful things that you can speak about as well from that same exact lens. And so, you know, just kind of being very intentional about making time and space and effort to keep the positivity around. You know?
It's such a great point, too, as you branch out and you get bigger and more mainstream, if you will, just this idea that you're speaking to much larger audiences, or at least different demographics, maybe. The idea that you are more than one thing.
Yeah.
You know, like when you were a kid, and even if you're some West Side rapper and you're rapping about one thing, or you really want to make sure people know that what your take is on this thing. It seems on this record, there's a flow to it that feels like at one point you'll be talking about what love is, and at another point you'll be talking about injustices and inequality. Yeah. But it all seems to be something that is intentional to show that there is it's well-rounded, that it's not just one thing that you do.
Yeah, it's really important to, you know, have the audience look at you as a three-dimensional human being. Is really easy these days when you say, hey, I'm a rapper, for a connotation to kind of like pop into people's heads or, you know, an opinion about what that means. And it's my job to like illuminate the many, many things that go on inside of my brain and inside of like my life as a person. I'm not just like all those hyphens in my job title. I am a person who experiences insomnia and anxiety and struggling with self-love, you know, and it's important to put that out there, because instead of trying to make everybody, you know, dance all the time and turn up all the time, my music is there for, you know, medicine, like when you need it, because that's the stuff that kind of got me through and I still listen to today. So like, it's really important to like show every side of you, because you never know who needs that, you know, that day.
Michael DeVille's in studio with me. His new album, Maintain, is out. He's going to be at the Logan Square Arts Festival this weekend, as well as dates coming up this summer. To be in this position where you're not only evolving as a musician, but you're attracting more attention. You know, you could evolve as a musician in the other way, right? But you are, I mean, it's really great to watch your career continue to aspire. Mm-hmm. What do you have to look out for? When you're talking about now you're creating this art and you've got the art on lock, you know exactly what you want to do and how you've evolved. Mm-hmm. But as you get bigger and more audiences are seeing you, festival stages, other places, what do you have to do to make sure that it's still authentic, that it's still you?
You know, not tuck myself inside of myself in order to make people happy. You know, I started in a really selfish place, you know, in a place in which, you know, I couldn't afford therapy. And so this was that for me. And if people got something out of watching it, that's awesome. If they didn't, I still needed to do it. And so to stay connected to that need, that need to speak, right? And acting is always this direction toward urgency, right? And if I can remember every time I get on stage that I wrote this for a specific reason, and that's going to evolve as I go, but never lose track of that, because you want people to dance or people to like you or anything like that. The bigger stages and bigger houses are like awesome, but you know, they can be very daunting if you don't see everybody in the crowd raising their hands up or moving or dancing when you're really trying to talk about injustice and you're trying to, you know, really educate and put out there your perspective. And so, you know, you just can't be intimidated by that, nor can you be intimidated by the people who tell you there's a specific lifestyle that you need to lead as a rapper in this city. This is not, I'm trying to upend all of that, who you are.
And I think about how Chicago's been supportive to hip hop, but it's also almost limiting in the way that, you're right, there are a lot of stereotypes that come into what kind of rapper you are if you're from Chicago. And we've seen that change, but even in the change, to say, you know, this is an independent, now it's, you got to be independent. There seems to be a way that we like to put the art of hip-hop in boxes.
And it's so seamless and expansive. It's so big. It's the ocean. It's what we speak, how when I go into classrooms, I get the respect of the younger students because I understand who they're talking about, how they're this is the language. And I just feel like to put anybody in a box or to say that I have to be the next Chance or, you know, anybody, you know, in the city is you'll be missing out on all the wonderful music that's actually happening, all the really free expression that's happening within the genre of hip hop alone if you start to categorize in that way. And I try to like kind of go against those things. You know,
you have a background as an actor. Mm-hmm. That was the first kind of part of your renaissance career that you've had. How does that help you now? How does it help you to have learned stagecraft as being a musician?
Oh, I mean, tremendously. It helps my voice. It helps me to articulate. We're in a time in hip hop where it's a lot more guttural, and I am the opposite of that. I think the best way to stand out is to kind of do what people aren't really doing or what isn't considered mainstream. And I like to turn the beat like down and have my voice fill up the space as much as possible. But I've learned how to project and restructure because of acting. I've learned how to like speak to a room of 450 people because of my experience with acting, and to hone in on, again, the urgency and the storytelling of even something that I've performed a million times. It's still a story to be told there, and it's probably the first time people have heard it. And so you know, you don't want to ever be lazy in that regard in your live performances. And so, like, I want to always, you know, step to it new, and acting has given me that. And so I'm glad to always still, even to this day, still have acting in my life, because it continues to challenge me and it continues to help me tell stories in a way that isn't just with my own words. It's a collaborative art, you know?
Yeah, you're able to learn from the people around you, but also, like you said, to be part of a community and collaborate.
Yeah.
How important is that in hip-hop? Because, you know, I think there is a stereotype that it's one guy, he's up there, maybe there's a beat playing on a DJ, and it's up to the one guy. It seems like a very, like, isolated art form, but there's, like, all
it's
art
so
forms, there are so many people around. Yeah,
it's so many people. I mean, it just goes into making the beat if you don't make beats yourself, right? Like, just your producers and the people who contribute to your artwork and the people who are making your posters and your merch, record label, or, you know, if you're with that, the community at large in general, you know, that's a collaboration. It's not just you in a vacuum up there. You're like looking at people and you're trying to connect with them. And if they're not rocking with you, you're not doing well as a collaborator. You know, you got to be generous as a collaborator. Yeah. And so I think hip hop is the most collaborative art form, just because, you know, put aside somebody featuring on my track, it takes a band to play it and to arrange it and to give me the sheet music so I can get other musicians to play for it. You know, it takes a base to build a brand and to like really feed into what it is you're trying to put out there in the world. So you need people in this art form. If you don't have that, you'll, you know, continue to just play basements and just for the same. But even then, you're playing for a specific insulated crowd, you know, and that is collaborative. So,
that's a great point, and I think that's something people don't pay too much attention to, is that it's not just collaboration with the artists on stage, but it's collaboration with the audience.
Yes, it's important, because if you... Nobody wants to hear the same album twice. You know, my albums are similar because I have a really important message that I'm trying to push home, which is to survive, which is to maintain, which is to find peace. These things are, in my mind, like timeless, and they need to constantly be repeated so people won't think that you're naively just kind of throwing these things out and judging people and telling them how to live their lives. And so, like, it's important to, you know, make sure that you listen after you put out a record, what people, how they respond. People send me messages all the time and say, like, yo, this helped me get through this and this helped me get through that. And that helps me to figure out, okay, what direction do I need to continue to write in? Maybe I need to do more therapeutic rapping about, you know, health institutions and trauma centers in the city, because people really feel that. So it's a back and forth. You need to have that kind of correspondence. If you don't, then you are rapping in a vacuum and it becomes this ego thing, which is the opposite of what I'm trying to do.
Westside hip hop artist, actor, poet, renaissance man, Michael DeVille in studio. The album is Maintain. You can find it everywhere. And he's playing all summer long, including the Logan Square Arts Festival this weekend.
Yep.
Michael, great to see you again.
Thank you so much.
Can't wait to talk again.
Yeah.
talk how you evolve when you turn 35.
Yeah.
Now, if I can smooth it out one time and kick a message that's been on my mind, is that fine?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, this how I spin it. We got a lot of rappers out here stuck on reminiscing, talking about how they used to be. They used to be good. Only concerned with the past and how they used to be hood. But what if right now? And who's that person in the mirror? Do you love them unconditionally? What? Let me hear ya. Don't it feel good to wake and rise another day? Fresh routine, another try. Beginning to feel like sunlight will always shine in my mind from that guy talking dreams that...
Well, there you go, celebrating 1989. Tonight here in Extension 720. Real treat. Steve and Johnny coming up next here on 720 WGN. So don't go nowhere.